The foundations of laws of the United Kingdom are framed on precedents and mores stretching back for hundreds of years in a contiguous pedigree unrivalled in any other part of the Western world. Consequently, with such a history in the practice of fine-tuning, English law is almost universally unequivocal. By this I mean that, barring the occasional notable exception that usually follows a knee-jerk reaction in the something-must-be-done faculty of legislature, look no further than the reprehensible Guard Dogs Act of 1975, since largely amended, UK criminal law is clear, unambiguous, and, crucially, quite absolute. Consider, for example, the law on theft, as described in the Theft Act 1968, arguably one of the most effective pieces of legal drafting in the post-war era, that, though subsequently amended, still has this definition in Section 1, Subsection 1, at its core. A person is guilty of theft if he dishonestly appropriates property belonging to another with the intention to permanently deprive the other of it. That's it. That's just beautiful. No argument. Simple, concise, unconditional, and devoid of the taxing minutiae that bedevil philosophers in deliberating how many angels could dance on the head of a pin. But therein lies the paradox in its absolutism. Dishonestly appropriate a battleship or a biro, it's still theft, and there is no accommodation in the definition for the magnitude of the acquisition, let alone the context or the mens rea, i.e., the intentional knowledge of the perpetrator, that then evokes questions of personal circumstances and mental state at the time of the offence. Fortuitously, entwined throughout the legal system, are the checks and balances that mitigate overzealous interpretations of statutes or the common law. The enviable tradition of trial by jury has its roots in Anglo-Saxon England, and the establishment of the magistracy dates back to the Justice of the Peace Act of 1361, many of the provisions of which are still in force today. Standing accused in front of one's fellow man or woman, females were first allowed on juries in 1920, affords judgment within the paradigm of honest and reasonable belief in strict liability cases, and the taking into account of mitigations and defences. Whilst not unique in this regard, the UK is up there in best practice. Conversely, the assiduously unyielding observance of every dot and full stop is a prerequisite to a totalitarian state. We don't do that. Thus has the law matured over the centuries, millennia even, into what we now take for granted as the cornerstone of a democratic, law-respecting society. However, and mindful that rushed law is inevitably bad law with all that entails for civic respect of it, I detect a shift in this exemplar away from our time-served protocols, and in a way that, though well-intentioned, may ultimately not bode well unless that historical balance is maintained. And I lay the cause at the feet of a trend that, coincidentally or otherwise, has seemed to proliferate commensurate with the prevalence of social media and its propensity to disseminate passion and subjectivity long before reason and objectivity have had time to strap their boots on. And that is the unfettered exposure and corrosive prosecution of the ism. There is a correlation here with the medical world, where the suffix itis, which simply means inflammation, can be appended to just about anything to describe a genetic condition pertaining to the prefix. For example, appendicitis, or inflammation of the appendix. Similarly, arthritis, gastritis, fibrositis, and so forth. Similarly, the suffix ism can be applied to elucidate a syndrome or a collation of signs and symptoms that are correlated with each other in a particular point of reference as described by the prefix. Some are munificent or benign conditions, hence altruism, philanthropism. Others may be more provocative, either in a positive or negative extent, depending on the perspective of the proponent, to wit, feminism, chauvinism, anti-Semitism. That one seems to merit a chapter all of its own. Ageism, sexism, despotism, fundamentalism, and the granddaddy of them all, racism. A perpetual thorn in the pan-societal rump that varies in its discomfiture depending on which side one sits, but which, despite occasional relief by shuffling around, never seems to completely go away, and a topic that rouses emotions well above its weight, even at the mention of its name. This exceptionally pernicious ism is defined by the Oxford English Dictionary as prejudice, discrimination, or antagonism directed against someone of a different race, based on the belief that one's own race is superior. Gosh, even the taciturn description of the condition cries out for an emollient to soothe the unease. Little wonder its practical application can realise such devastating consequences. Yes, indeed, the OED definition is textually elegant in being unequivocal and absolute. But I contend that, just as with our definition of theft, which is trite in a comparison of gravitas but nonetheless amply makes the point regarding their mutual clarity, it must be interpreted within the round. This is not to dilute that interpretation, but to aid the mix to the desired strength in a holistic solution of minimal toxicity. Now, that's not the sort of sentence that one should leave unattended for too long, so I think I'd better explain my reasoning behind it. Let's start with Idi Amin, a Ugandan military officer who served as president from 1971 to 1979. Being popularly known as the Butcher of Uganda probably says it all about this particularly abominable psychopath. He's considered one of the most brutal despots in world history, and his rule was characterized by rampant human rights abuses, political repression, ethnic persecution, extrajudicial killings, nepotism, corruption, and gross economic mismanagement. International observers estimate that up to 500,000 people were killed under his regime. Now that's a top-of-the-range racist at the peak of his game. Then there's the equally charming Robert Mugabe. Having dominated Zimbabwe's politics for nearly four decades, he stands accused of being a dictator responsible for economic mismanagement, corruption, anti-white racism, human rights violations, and crimes against humanity. And finally, in this trio diabolique, I give you Adolf Hitler. What more need one say? Historian Ian Kershaw neatly sums up this ultra-egotistical maniac in one coruscating sentence. Never in history has such ruination, physical and moral, been associated with the name of one man. Sadly, the list goes on, engulfing at various times huge swathes of humanity under its scope of malevolence. Joseph Stalin, Mao Zedong, Pol Pot, Eugene Terblanche. At a local level, we can cite the killers of Stephen Lawrence as representative of a sad litany of ethnically motivated serious crimes that are now endemic in many of our major cities. Racists, every man jack of them, and all fitting squarely into our definition. Now, compare and contrast these with the example from March 2019 of a BBC interview in which white politician Amber Rudd referred to black politician Diane Abbott as coloured. Notwithstanding the former was being supportive of the latter in sympathising with her treatment on social media and elsewhere, which per se is patently offensive, the use of that one word sparked Twitter storms of controversy. Abbott herself said, "The term coloured is an outdated, offensive and revealing choice of words." Note to self. Revealing of what exactly? Whilst Danielle Rowley, the Labour MP for Midlothian, helpfully tweeted, "Amber Rudd undermining an important point about online abuse by referring to Diane Abbott as a coloured woman on at BBC Radio 2. She clearly gets her language from the same bygone era as her abhorrent welfare policies." Really? The inferences were clear. In fact, there are those who went beyond inference in ramping up the rhetoric to declare Rudd a blatant racist, and thanks to the miracles of technology, a hitherto essentially private spat was opened up for unencumbered comment across the planet from those who also felt offended by proxy on Ms. Abbott's behalf. Rudd responded to the storm with a dignified apology. "Mortified at my clumsy language and sorry to at Hackney Abbott," she tweeted, My point stands that no one should suffer abuse because of their race or gender. Quite right. Though here is a fascinating fact, courtesy of the Wikipedia School of Philosophy. The term women of colour surfaced in the USA in the Violence Against Women movement. In the late 70s, it unified all women experiencing multiple layers of marginalisation with race or ethnicity as a common issue. Back in the 1960s, I remember the first boy of West Indian descent to join our otherwise all-white infant school. They were interesting times as we adjusted to this strange newcomer and vice versa. His name was Tony and we became good friends for a while until our paths parted on changing schools. It was all a very long time ago, but I well recall how any signs of inappropriate conduct towards him were quickly diffused by our teachers literally banging heads together. Altogether now, all of those over a certain age who remember when teachers actually did that. Nowadays, of course, the expression is purely allegoric, and anyone below state retirement age would not even appreciate the metaphor, let alone its efficacy in modifying errant juvenile behaviour. How times change. 60 years later, Amber Rudd committed the cardinal error of negotiating the hot embers of personal sensitivities whilst wearing hobnail boots instead of ballet shoes. Perhaps her comments were crass, insensitive, maybe for someone who should be expected to have well-honed political antennae, even misguided or plain ignorant. But in denouncing her as a racist, are we truly comfortable in conflating this unfortunate episode with that same fire-breathing chimera of hatred and bigotry that begat the likes of Amin, Mugabe and Hitler? Ah, thank goodness for those historic aspects of our legislature, the glues that bind us, that have over centuries become embedded in our cultural psyche, and which allow us to identify the degree of culpability and, in turn, avoid us treading the slippery slopes towards despotism. But in doing so, we must also respect the delicacy of the dividing line. At the end of the day, steal a battleship or steal a barrow, theft is theft and it's wrong. Racism is racism, that is wrong too, and must be countered with that ultimate vigour with which we defend all of our values. Yet, in apportioning to transgressors the appropriate measure of criticism, censure or punishment, it will remain to our eternal credit as a society that we continue to exercise the judgment of degree.